I teach at the law school at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana, and I've been teaching there for 25 years. One of the subjects that I've taught that entire time is the course in criminal law. One of the issues that we take up in that course every year is the insanity defense. And what I'd like to do this evening is to talk a little bit about the history of using the insanity defense in criminal trials, and then talk a little bit about how my students, at least, and other people that I've talked to about it, react to it, and what they bring to that issue, in particular, what it is about that subject that makes them very, very nervous, or angry, or disillusioned, or whatever, to the point where they're willing to make some pretty rash judgments about what we should do about it. And what I want to do is unpack some of those feelings and maybe classify them. Maybe we can help a little bit to straighten out what those feelings are all about. I think they're all ultimately based in some real difficult problems that we have to sort through. First of all, when we talk about the insanity defense, it's not clear initially what kind of question that even is. I love to put circles on the board. And I did last night, and I did again tonight. The insanity defense could be thought of as coming from any one of three places. Certainly, it's a legal concept. After all, it's a statute or a legislature that tells us what the legal meaning of insanity is. Insanity, by the way, is not a clinical term. It's not a medical term. It's never used by clinicians. I always tell my students, the only sure symptom of insanity is acquittal. Because insanity isn't a clinical term anyway. A therapist would never use the term because it doesn't help her. So it's strictly a legal idea. Insanity is also a moral question. And it's at that level that many of us think about it and deal with it and worry about it. It is, of course, also a clinical question. And so we get a lot of different players in this arena, all with their own way of looking at things. On the legal side, we get a number of actors. We get the legislature, who writes the statute telling us what the legal meaning of insanity is. We get the judge. The judge during the trial, that pen's running out. Change colors. The judge during the trial does a number of things. First of all, he tells the jury what the legal definition is. He also tells the jury what they are to make of the people down here, and the people down here are expert witnesses. There are some very definite rules now as to what expert witnesses can say and cannot say in a criminal trial in which insanity is a defense. And where does the moral voice come from? From the jury. Okay. So the jury who decides in each case whether or not insanity will be, as a defense, will work, they're representing the moral judgment of the community. As a defense, the first indications we have of it is in the 12th century. We have some indications that in some cases in Great Britain during the 12th century, people were exonerated from the criminal system on what the reporters tell us only was madness. That was the word, that's the original word, madness. And of course, what happened to those people was they were not put through the criminal system. They weren't permitted to walk around either. They were committed to some kind of institution. And we're not exactly certain what kind of institution that was. But at any rate, they weren't convicted of crime. These appear, however, only to be cases where it was absolutely certain to everybody that we were dealing with some. These were not marginal cases. These were very definite cases. The first important case, historically, is a case called Macnaughton's case. And some of you may have heard about that. But a little before 1843, Daniel Macnaughton, a young Irish rebel, had the bad form to shoot a member of the House of Lords in London. Bad enough to kill, but when you kill someone in the House of Lords, this gets the attention of the crown. Everyone who came in contact with Daniel knew he was crazy. There was no question about it. Everybody knew that, and his case was disposed of within days. He was simply put away for the rest of his life. There was no criminal trial. There was no need for that. He was just crazy. What we remember the case for is not the decision, but after the case, the House of Lords was asked to write down, how do we know in the next case when someone is insane and when they're not? What is the legal meaning of insanity? And on the green sheet, I have for you what the House of Lords said in Daniel McNaughton's case. Actually, there's a wonderful story about Daniel McNaughton. You see the spelling there, M-apostrophe-N-A-G-H-T-E-N. For about 45 years, there was a tremendous scholarly debate over how to spell his name. Some had it M-C, some had it M-A-C. The Scotch didn't like that because Daniel was Irish. Some had it M-C-N-C, with an old Gaelic spelling. Finally, the debate came to an end when they found a letter written by the prisoner, Daniel McNaughton, in his own hand. That quieted the debate for 2 months, until one scholar, who obviously had a lot written, said, "You're going to take the word of a madman?" And so the debate started up again. We just rejected as significant Daniel's own stuff. Here's what they say. And the critical part starts about halfway down. The party accused was laboring under such a defect of reason from disease of the mind as to not know the nature and quality of the act he was doing, or if he did know it, that he did not know he was doing what was wrong. So the basic way that court talked about the case, or the House of Lords said, the real thing we need to find out legally is, did he know that he was doing wrong? That sounds like a fairly straightforward question, doesn't it? Does he know he was doing wrong? Provided you can get agreement on a couple key words in there. No turns out to be a tricky word, and wrong turns out to be even trickier. For example, what about someone who commits a crime because he is persuaded through illness that God has commanded him to commit that crime? Is he doing what he knows to be wrong? Yeah. Wrong by what standard? Well, certainly wrong by the criminal law standard. The criminal law says you shall not do this, and let's say kill, because that's usually the way these cases come up. But he says, well, pardon me, but in my book, God is bigger than the legislature of this state. And if God tells me to do something, then by definition it can't be wrong. It's what I ought to do. So there's some ambiguity here to it. But the main thing to notice about it is that it treats insanity strictly as a defect of the intellectual apparatus, the cognitive apparatus. That is, do you know it's wrong? It doesn't take any account of the control side, of the volitional side. That comes later. And you see here the Parsons case number 2 in 1887. That's a very, very early version of it. It isn't really until the 1930s, until psychiatry begins to have enough adherence and have enough clout politically to be heard by the legal system. And what the therapeutic community tells the legal system is this. Most people who are, in our estimation, not responsible for their actions, still pass the McNaughton test. They know right from wrong. Their problem is they can't stop themselves from doing what they know is wrong. And so this new test then in the 1930s adds to the idea of, do you know right from wrong, another way to prove insanity, and that is, can you help doing what you did? The so-called irresistible impulse. Well, this made everybody very nervous. First of all, there's a whole lot more of that type than of the don't know right from wrong. I have a good friend who's a clinician, and he says, I got a lot of patients. They all know right from wrong. That's not their problem. Their problem is they've lost control of what they do. Okay? He said, if you talk to me about someone who doesn't know right from wrong, you're not talking about an insane person, you're talking about a grapefruit. I just don't meet people like that. That's not the way it happens. Okay? Here's what troubled people about. How do you tell the difference between an irresistible impulse and an impulse which just wasn't resisted? After all, every time you do anything, it was one of those two. Right? And that became a real problem. We'll come back to that. The absolute high watermark for the insanity defense is reached in 1954 in a case called Durham versus the United States that came out of the District of Columbia Circuit. And what this test basically does is take the whole problem and sort of abdicate the law's responsibility and make it totally a clinical question. An accused is not criminally responsible if his unlawful act was the product of mental disease or mental defect. Now, one thing that did do is it really opened up expert testimony. The good psychiatrists used to say prior to the Durham test, if the defense lawyer went to them and said, would you testify? And he said, well, what's the test for insanity? Well, the test is he doesn't know right from wrong. Most of the good clinicians would say, well, I can't give you that testimony. I just don't believe that. I don't believe he ought to be responsible. I believe he has all kinds of problems, but this is some test. Okay? This is hard to meet this test. And so what a lot of them did was basically, and I know there's some psychiatrists here, I know there's some clinicians here, and I hate to say this about your colleagues, but basically what they did was they fudged it. And yes, they fudged it with the help of lawyers. Are you surprised? And so what the lawyer and the psychiatrist would sort of agree on goes like this. The psychiatrist would say, well, I really can't say he doesn't know right from wrong, but we all know he shouldn't be responsible. Since we can't rewrite the test, what we'll do is say, yes, he can't tell right from wrong. What we'll mean is, we don't believe he ought to be responsible for his actions. But since the only vocabulary you'll accept is this right-wrong business, we'll have to talk that way. And a lot of that happened. The Durham case at least had the value of putting an end to that. Now the psychiatrist could come in and talk in clinical terms. He could use vocabulary that made sense to him or to her because that's what he dealt with. They didn't deal with this kind of right-wrong stuff. It just wasn't part of their lexicon. Durham was the high watermark. It lasted in the jurisdiction which passed it only about 8 years and was never passed in another jurisdiction. Might have been passed in Maine, but that's open to question whether they did or they didn't. The current test that most states use is the American Law Institute test on the back. See if any of it seems familiar to you. This is they put this forth as a new test for legal insanity. A person is not responsible for criminal conduct if, at the time of such conduct, as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality. Oh, sounds a little like McNaughton, except, notice this move. The move from know to appreciate. And that's very important to a clinician. Appreciate means something very different from know. There's a lot of things we can know intellectually, but we haven't integrated them into our behavior. We don't act as if we know them. We had three children, and when each was little, we told them, do not touch the coils on the stove when they are orange. Actually, don't touch them ever, but especially when they are orange. The oldest and the youngest simply accepted what we said as having some sense coming from parents. But of course, the middle child, what a surprise, decided that he would determine this on his own. So when he was, and my wife thinks 3 or 4, that's about right, he went by it and put his hands on the orange coils of the electric stove. All three of my children know not to touch those coils, but Eric appreciates. And to this day, he walks through the kitchen a foot further from that stove than the others do. And that's sort of what a clinician means by appreciate, integrated it, act as if it's part of the reality. Notice the other thing that the test does. Long becomes criminal. It actually becomes the noun, criminality. But it solves the question of what do you mean by wrong? Wrong in criminal law terms. So if God tells you to kill, you still know that it's criminal, because criminal has the limited meaning of violates the criminal law. So criminal is a less ambiguous word than wrong. Query about whether it's a better word in here. And some states have gone back and changed criminality to wrongfulness anyway, because they want to leave that question ambiguous. Why? Where are they? Here they are. Because they want the jury to make that call in each individual case. They want the jury, as the moral conscience of the community, to tell us whether wrong ought to mean the criminal law or ought to mean wrong in a larger sense. I want to make the claim tonight that all objections to the insanity defense that I've ever heard, now maybe tonight I'll have to create a third category, but every objection and concern I've ever heard falls into two broad categories. One, we do not recognize as significant. Either we don't recognize it at all, or at least we don't recognize it as significant, a difference between illness and evil. That is, we don't think it is legally relevant, the difference between illness and evil. Let me give you some things to put into the hopper on this question. Read someday, and I'm sure you all have, but read someday again with a view toward this, the book of Job. And take a look at what almost all the questioners of Job assumed when they spoke to him. Why was Job in this terrible condition?
He
had done something wrong. This was punishment. This was payment. Okay? And it's too bad that all this happened, but there it was. Think today of the reaction of people when they hear that someone has the disease of AIDS.
Got what he deserved.
Do you think we're entirely free of the notion that illness and evil don't have some interconnection? Often I hear this one. Someone commits a terrible, terrible offense. Let's say a mass killing or a multiple killing. And someone will say, if the issue is, was he insane when he did that? They'll say, he'd have to be. Anyone who would do that would have to be insane. I'm not sure that they mean what they're saying when they say that. But to the extent that they're clear on what they're saying, they are in effect saying, we do not recognize as significant any difference between illness and evil. I'll give you another one looked at from the other way. A judge in a case, and this was a multiple murder case, a friend of mine was prosecuting it, pre-tried it, talked to the judge about a lot of the issues in the case, and then the judge turned to the defense counsel and said, what is your theory of the case? And he said, our theory of the case is that the defendant was insane when he did this. And the judge's response was, God, I hope so. Because illness turned out in the judge's mind to be a better explanation than the other. So sometimes we do one of two things. We either say that everybody who would do this is ill, or we say that everybody who would do this is evil. It doesn't matter which you say everybody is. The point is you're not recognizing the distinction. And we have a wonderful word that means them both. Okay? He killed three people? What a blank thing.
Crazy.
crazy.
Or sick.
Sick.
Sick's a beauty, isn't it? Because we... She has 104 temperature. She's sick.
Bill, that joke is sick. We use that. We use the word both ways, right? And whenever you hear someone use the word sick in a debate upon the insanity defense, let me tell you what they're doing. They're trying to cover that difference. They're trying to give you a word that you'll interpret either way, depending on what they want you to hear or what you want to hear. My guess is more of us are down here. More people object to this or have deep concerns about it because they are not confident that we can tell illness and evil apart. And let me give you part of how that plays out. You hear all of the following things. Psychology and psychiatry are relatively young sciences and arts and can't be expected at this point to have reached the levels that some of the older sciences have reached. So there's that, the kind of emerging science idea. Most mental illnesses don't have clear physical markers. That is, they are not verifiable in the same way that physical illness is verifiable. After all, you take an x-ray. If someone claims to have a broken leg, it's easy to check. Think about it this way. You may doubt whether someone's mentally ill when they raise the insanity defense. Do you ever have any doubt about people with retardation? There are all kinds of physical markers to that. There are ways to check that, right? So we don't react that. We don't react with suspicion there. We react in a different way. We'll talk about more of that in a second. There are a lot of fakers. Everybody wants to fake the insanity defense. After all, get you off. That's worth talking about. You know, the only crime we ever hear insanity raised as a defense to is murder. And do you know why? Because the penalty for being found insane is worse than the penalty for being found guilty of most crimes. Only murder has a worse penalty than the penalty for insanity, because everyone who is acquitted on the basis of insanity goes to a mental health facility. And when will they get out? Hard to know. Maybe never, maybe tomorrow. Both of those things make various people nervous. Right? The thing about the faker argument is this, and most people say, well, I can fake it, so let's do away with that as a defense. That's easy to say, and if you don't think about it too long, you can kind of persuade yourself that that's the answer. But let me try this one on. It's possible to fake self-defense. So what? We should do away with the defense of self-defense? Well, we hear that he was trying to kill you and you just shot to protect yourself, but you can't have that defense because too many people could fake that one. So to cover that, we'll have to put you in jail for 30 years, 40 years, whatever. We don't react that way to that. It may be that it's harder to fake self-defense because we have better access to how that works. The fact that there's a scientific question here that a lot of us don't have much access to, played out in what seems to the layman a funny jargon, is part of the problem. The other thing, in my mind, has to do with physical illness and mental illness. I want to just try to introduce this real quick and then open it up for questions. I want to give you four statements here. And I want you to just sort of react viscerally and emotionally here. Jane broke her leg hiking today.
Oh. Poor Jane.
Poor Jane. Isn't that awful? By the way, does the real Jane have a broken leg? Or is the broken leg just something that happened to the real Jane? And therefore it's only temporary. And there'll be a period of convalescence, but then it will knit. And then the real Jane that we've all known all along will come out again with an unbroken leg. And the broken leg will be simply a piece of her history, not a piece of her being. Jane broke her leg hiking today. I hope there's no one named Jane who broke their leg. Bill has been deaf since birth. Is that harder? Can the real Bill hear? Is deafness something that happened to Bill? Or is it just something that Bill is? And what do we mean by that? I think most of us don't have too much problem imagining, at least, that there could be a real Bill who wasn't deaf. That this is just something that happened to him, but it happened to him earlier than Jane's leg happened to her.
There's also a different agency in your verse.
Yeah, why is that?
Jane broke her leg. Mm-hmm. Bill has been deaf.
We could have said Jane suffered a broken leg.
Right. But there isn't none.
Or Dick broke Jane's leg.
Right.
Yeah.
at least the first one leaves the possibility that Jane is somehow responsible for breaking her leg.
Okay.
Instead of saying too bad, if you knew Jane, you might say, oh, and isn't that just the sort of thing Jane would do? I suppose she was climbing up some rock where she wasn't supposed to be.
Right. Just like he has AIDS, got what comes from, right? Yeah, that kind of thing.
And deafness, deaf might not be totally deaf. I mean, we don't have any notion
right.
as to how deaf is from birth.
Okay, yeah. You see, I'm beginning to get the impression that this is my law class back home. People are going to pick on every word. What tense did you put that sentence in? Why do we have passive voice going there? Right? So everybody, see, you're learning how to become lawyers. That is, pick at everything. Right? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. What?
I'm out of here.
I get to grade their exam, so I've got a little leverage. I keep a little control there. Sue is a paranoid schizophrenic. Oh, get a little quieter there. Didn't get an immediate reaction. Poor Sue.
Her poor family.
Huh?
Her poor family.
Yeah, or poor family, right. Right. Why is that? Why does that strike you different? Is part of it because you're not sure what that means? Is part of it because you suspect there's no way to verify that? Is part of that because you expect one psychiatrist would say it's true and another would say it's not quite true? That Sue is really something else?
I suppose there are various degrees of either one of them.
Yeah.
It would be difficult. It could be.
And Sue could be faking.
Oh, no.
Right?
No.
She couldn't be?
No.
Sue couldn't be fake. Oh, now tell me about how she couldn't be.
If you've ever met a paranoid schizophrenic, I don't think there's too much faking in it.
They don't want to.
Some good actors have studied it and made a point of faking it. This is a fact.
There are a number of instances where, at least the best we can tell, a lot of people who engage in certain kind of killings are very intrigued with mental illness to begin with, do a lot of reading about it, and get to the point where they can mimic the symptom. There's a wonderful story of someone who was doing a master's thesis back in the 1960s and wanted to test the theory. Studied schizophrenia, learned to mimic it, had himself checked in to a psychiatric hospital in California. Persuaded the staff that he had this illness, took all the notes. He was, a lot of this had to do with getting in the inside to see how the hospital worked, to do his research project. After about 3 months, he was done. And he went to the desk and said, oh, see, I'm really a graduate student. And
Sure you are, Bill. You're a graduate student, right? And it took him another 2 weeks to get out. Okay? It can be faked.
Was this before or after Ronald Reagan closed the mental hospitals?
No, it's before. Yeah, yeah. This was before. Let's try one more. Dick is an evil man. I've no particular person named Dick. Does that strike any of you as a different sort of statement than the first three?
Yeah.
Do you? How do you react to it differently?
He's a bad person.
It's a judgment without. It's a judgment that doesn't seem to have a whole lot of substance there, at least. I mean, you might say, how is he evil? But
right. I'm thinking of all of these things as a thing we would say at the culmination of an investigation, not at the beginning of it. So after everything we've studied, let's say Dick is up on trial for murder, and he's raising the insanity defense.
I'd say the biggest How would you test for evil? You can test for paranoid schizophrenia. You can test for broken plates. You can test for devils. But you can't test where's the.
I think there's a
mode. Well, it seems to me that at least in a criminal case, evil is the residue of illness. That is, if you rule out insanity in a murder case, and if you rule out all the other good reasons for committing the crime, then aren't we, by engaging in a criminal conviction, saying something like, you are a bad person, you are to be morally condemned. There was a wonderful article in the 1950s by Henry Hart. And the early 1950s was the kind of heyday of the rehabilitative model. No one was to be punished. Everybody was to be rehabilitated. You committed murder, well, we're going to make you better. Okay? And there's some great C.S. Lewis stuff that says that's crueler than just punishing. Okay? Making people better against their will is morally quite different from simply punishing them for breaking the law. Henry Hart said this: what separates a criminal conviction from any other kind of finding about that person, whether it's clinical or whether it's he needs to pay money in a civil case. But what distinguishes a criminal conviction is the moral condemnation of the community that attends and justifies it. That's why this is such a critical problem. The difference between acquitting on insanity and convicting is not necessarily a difference of where that person's going to go or how many years that person's going to spend isolated. It's a different kind of thing that we do when we convict. What we in effect label the person. And we say, you were bad. And we had a rule about this. You broke the rule. And the interesting thing about it is, as I said before, there's a sense in which we're treating that person better because we're at least saying you are responsible for your actions and this is the price we've told you you have to pay. The acquittal on insanity, whole different thing. Let me stop, yeah.
This raises a key point that I've heard people discuss. They say, we don't like the verdict innocent by reason of insanity. We would prefer to have them say guilty but insane, and we could say either guilty but insane at the time of the crime or guilty but presently insane. And those two things would determine what happens to the person if they get well later, whether they would have to serve out their sentence because they committed the crime while they were sane but became insane later, or that they truly were over this particular episode in their life and could go on and be worthy, productive citizens. I throw this out because it's been part of a discussion that they dislike the idea of innocent by reason of insanity. Innocence doesn't sound right to the common man for a case that is obviously a bad happening.
Right. And I think that's one of the hardest things
for to get past.
Yes.
Let me try. At least to get you into the mentality of the way a law student looks at this, which may be not to actually increase your behavior or your knowledge, but to decrease it.
Okay.
I tell the law students when they come in, this may be as bright as you'll ever be, because we're going to begin to work to do some different things to you. Whether someone is guilty in the criminal law is not just a function of what they did. It's not just a function of their action. It's a function of their action together with a particular kind of mental state. That's why we're so careful in the criminal law to prove that people did things on purpose or intentionally. A person who carelessly drives a car and hurts someone is different on the criminal side than someone who ran them down on purpose. Okay? Not necessarily saying neither is guilty of any crime, but they're guilty of a very different crime.
Right.
Okay? But I find most people say, look, he killed him. What's the rest of the deal? Why are we talking anymore? Well, because the criminal law has always insisted on wanting to know not just did he do a particular action, but why did he do it? What was the mental condition under which he did it? What excuses did he have? What justifications? If you heard that someone killed somebody to defend themselves, what would you think about that? That's okay, right? So you don't even believe that...
Although it's not to some people, believe it or not. But I do. I agree with you with this. I believe in defense, but some people do not.
Some people do not. That's correct. Some people have an ethic of total pacifism, and you should rather let yourself be killed than to strike back. But that's not certainly our law.
No.
Okay? And my guess is most people would say, yes, you can defend yourself. Okay. Well, you've already then said that it's not wrong to kill always. That is, you're willing to say there are cases in which your actions are either justified or excused. Now, excuse is different from justification. That's a big jump philosophically. And insanity is a defense of excuse, not a defense of justification. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a big problem for many people. Yeah.
When the legal profession benevolently took in the clinical professions to help them out with this matter, especially insanity, there must have been some kind of long-term stipulation that would say, if a person's found insane, that indeed we, the medical profession, can make him either insane or at least give you a good guarantee that he will not do anything again by virtue of insanity. Has that been followed up on? Was that ever part of the stipulation, or is there any research to prove that these people are not repeat offenders?
It's true now in every state that if someone is acquitted on the grounds of insanity, either that automatically amounts to institutionalization under the mental health power, or it triggers a hearing to see if that person needs to be hospitalized. In theory, that person remains there so long as the clinicians believe that he represents a danger to himself or society if left out. Okay. Now, do they sometimes get it wrong? Well, predicting whether someone is dangerous in the future, I can't imagine a riskier kind of prediction to have to make. I always look at it this way. I'm not all that clear about the past. And now you're asking me about the future, about what the person may do. Real tough call. But I think what makes people nervous, and this is part of your comment too, why people say we'd rather have something like guilty but mentally ill, and a lot of states do. Because at least then, if the clinical community decides he is now cured, okay, instead of coming out, he'll go back to prison and he'll serve out all the period of his years. Okay, so if it's 60 years, 30 years, whatever it is. I find that to be fine, except I find the compromise to be interesting. The problem is it makes no sense to me in theory. If we don't believe the person was responsible for his actions at the time, why in the world would we want to hold him after we determine he's no longer dangerous? On what theoretical basis?
do we keep that person's liberty from it?
That's why I made the difference between at the time of the event or it happened later, which is sometimes the case.
But yeah, that's something that should be documentable over a given period of time, namely when these people are released to the public, and it should be very clear-cut whether they measure up to the non-insane people or repeat offenders.
No, they don't. They don't.
I mean, whether they are as...
But they do better than the people who come out of prison.
Yeah.
Now, that's what I didn't know.
Yeah, they do better than people come out of prison, but they don't do as well as the general population. One of the other things you hear here a lot is the phrase temporary insanity.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite of all time, temporary insanity. There's no such thing. A clinician will tell you there's no such thing. It's the defense lawyer's dream. Well, he was insane then, he's fine now. Guess what? We acquit him and he walks out the door, right? What a clinician will say is, there's no temporary insanity. What you have are people who have an underlying illness, which only manifests itself under certain kinds of conditions. Even people who are psychotic, or many people who are psychotic, look absolutely normal most of the time. It's just under certain kind of stresses, certain kind of triggers, that bring this underlying illness out. So it's not really that they're insane now, not insane, insane, insane. It's just that they always have this illness, except that you can only see its manifestations at certain points in time.
How about somebody like Patty Hearst, who was under certain kinds of enormous pressures and deprivation? And then, if I remember correctly, the trial, they did not let the expert witness on the psychiatric side come to her defense.
No. Right. Yeah. They were trying to run, I can't remember the name of it, maybe one of the clinicians in the audience can.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, Stockholm Syndrome. And lawyers have been trying to run post-traumatic stress syndrome. A lot of the Vietnam veterans cases went through that.
Yeah.
Battered spouse syndrome is being run. Usually, though, that's a kind of a self-defense, not an insanity claim.
But delayed, so that there's a problem.
Yeah. Well, Patty Hearst, the defense wasn't successful. One of the things that the press tries to move here is that all you got to do is raise the insanity defense. You fool a couple of psychiatrists, you fool the jury, and you walk free. Right? Well, think of all the people in your lifetime, major case, who have raised the defense where it's been successful. Name one. Think about it. Patty Hearst raised it, didn't work.
Hinckley.
Worked for him. Where is he, by the way? He hasn't seen the light of day since. Because he was found insane. Right? So he's still, I think he's still alive, and I think he's in D.C.
Virginia.
In Virginia?
Elizabeth Hospital.
Yeah. But it didn't work for Juan Corona, didn't work for Charles Manson. Have you ever seen Charles Manson?
Yeah.
I just look at his picture and go, crazy. Next case. Next case. I don't need any more.
That's a tattoo.
In fact, the actor who played him is also crazy in my mind, or the best actor I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
Interesting thing is that this phrase is for people who have a doctrine of original sin. Is that everyone is evil. I mean, those of us who use a certain ritual every Sunday, get up and confess, I'm in bondage to sin and cannot free myself. Well, that's sort of like, I am an evil person, right?
Miserable worm is how I used to have to say it as a kid.
So, there's something interesting going on here about responsibility. If I'm sick, I'm not responsible. If I'm evil, I am responsible. What's going on there in our anthropology of how we understand what it is to be human?
That's where it starts to get real nervous.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It depends on how much it affects somebody else. I mean, the extent of what happened. I mean, we are evil, but some of it doesn't seem quite as abhorrent.
Right. One thing that I'll get to you in just a second, sir. One thing that I think is real important. I've got a very good friend who runs the mental health service near where we are, and what he says is this. The mental health business basically gets creamed with the insanity defense, because the moment you talk about mental illness, what image pops to mind? The crazed killer. And he says it makes it real hard for people to come forward when they have depression, when they have other forms of mental illness that we can treat, because the stigma from the community is, you're mentally ill? Who, you know, did you kill the Clutter family? Exactly, you know, remember that one in Kansas? And so it has that kind of backlash. That's where we see it. I thought once it would be fabulous to study kleptomania as a defense to theft, because it can't fail. It's a known typology. It's testable. The thefts never make any sense in those cases. There are always people who don't need the stuff. It's just shiny stuff. And so we went to the books, because I figured, you know, I wonder how often this defense is successful. You know how successful it is? It's never been raised. Do you know why? Because theft is, what, 6 months in some states, at worst. Whereas kleptomania is an indeterminate amount of time in the institution. Yes, sir?
I'm just going to say, sometimes these people are psychologically affected. They're very shrewd and very intelligent and very, very smart. And so I ran into those when I was in the service. I was in charge of a psycho ward.
Right.
Boy, I'll tell you, one time there he was having everybody collect these sleeping pills and so on and so forth and give them to him.
Right.
And then he was trying to talk some of the people to take enough pills to commit suicide. Luckily enough, we caught him before it happened, but that was his intention. So they're very shrewd.
Many of them are highly intelligent. Their IQs are just phenomenal. There's a great story about the guy. He's driving past a mental hospital. And his wheel falls off the car. And he's putting it back on with five bowls. And two of them run away from him into a drain under there. And he's sitting there, now what am I going to do? And there's someone sitting on the wall who obviously belongs in the institution, says, look, you've got three left. Put them on every other one, and then go slowly to the next gas station where you can get two more. And the guy says, that's amazing. I'm out here and didn't think of that. You're in there and did think of that. And the guy says, I'm in here because I'm crazy, not stupid. Okay. It's a way of looking at it, yeah.
I mean, I appreciate what you're bringing up. I'm a psychiatrist, and so my people, they're people. They have an emotional or a psychiatric illness, but they're people with intelligence. They're also people who are crafty at times. They're also people who are physicians and lawyers and homemakers. I mean, we have to remember that, and I appreciate what you said, is that the worst thing that can reinforce the stigma is the insanity defense. Because that's when we hear about these people, but we run into them every day of our lives,
right.
And they're among us. And most, the vast percentage are doing very well against great odds.
Right.
And
right.
So I just had to say that because I think
appreciate
that, and I appreciate what you said too, that the insanity defense is only used in murder. I didn't know that. And that is kind of an indictment, isn't it, about our mental health system.
Yeah.
That yeah. Any other person would choose jail versus a psychiatric hospital.
The only case I can remember where it was run to something less was Hinckley, who ran it to attempted murder. But it was attempted murder of the President of the United States. So
that's locked for life.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Even a threat against the President,
right.
I think, is locked.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, this is kind of in keeping with what he's saying. Actually, the mentally ill have more offenses against them
yes.
than they ever offend the public. the percentage of the mentally ill is probably who commit any of these things is, I think, what, 5% or something? That's not that big a segment of that population.
Right.
But like your number three, when we saw that, any newspaper you read, you know, they will say, for example, if it's a manic depressive or something, he committed suicide, and then they'll say he was a manic depressive, which immediately gives this message to some of the youth who suffer this, you know, that your chances are, you know. So it's a delicate area because it is a genetic issue.
Right.
And like all the illnesses that we experience, come from here. So it is interesting, but I know your perspective on it is, you know, you were going a different direction with it.
Yeah, on the criminal side, but it's certainly true that the tail kind of wags the dog, that's what you think about. That's the high-profile case. And you're both right that stigmatizes everybody else unfairly.
Exactly. A jury with lack of knowledge in that area would be swayed in certain ways.
Right. There was a television program called Frontline many years ago, the news show, and they did a two-hour tape on the Hillside Strangler. Now, we're in the state where the Hillside Strangler lived. He was from Bellingham, Washington. The Hillside Strangler, you may remember, killed many women up and down the West Coast, but mostly in California, was finally located. And then there developed this tremendous legal psychiatric battle about, was he crazy or not? He claimed to be a multiple personality. A very rare kind of illness, but a very intriguing one. A lot of books, Sybil, you may remember, Three Faces of Eve, a number of others. But can claim to be a multiple personality, which is a wonderful illness to have if you're tried for murder, because you claim one of the other personalities was the one who did the killing, and you weren't even in control of the body. You were, you know, out getting a rub down at the time or something, and the other person was running the body, right? Three psychiatrists. One, to the very end, said he's a multiple personality, everything he says is true. Another one, who just didn't know. And one who said, testified for the prosecution, that he wasn't. All of the tapes were viewed, and one of the things that was neat about this tape is they had a lot of the actual footage of Ken himself, the suspect himself, being interrogated. And it was chilling. But they couldn't get any of the clear markings that they get in some multiple cases. In some multiple cases, when the personalities switch, the pulse rate changes, a lot of other autonomic responses change. I mean, it's really, really, but they couldn't get that in this case. They had a psychiatrist from UCLA, Margaret Singer, who looked at all the tapes, very, very fine psychiatrist, strict Freudian by training. She said, maybe Ken is this, maybe Ken is that, this could be. And then the very last scene, the camera comes right in on her face. And here's the strict Freud. She looks at the camera and says, and maybe he was just evil. Ooh, you know, ooh, what does that mean? You know, how do we get to there? But that's really, if you ever get can get access to that tape, there's a book out about the Bianchi case. When they searched his apartment after they identified who he was, they found 30 books on psychiatry, psychology, multiple personality. And it turns out, I mean, when the police found that, they said, this is it. We can't lose this case now. This guy is studying this stuff. But it turns out that the people who actually had that illness are themselves very intrigued with it and would do that reading anyway. So it's hard to know.
On some of that about all of us are evil or whatnot, and I really don't care if they're insane or not insane or whatnot, but I think that they need to be put away to protect society.
Right. I think at some level what you're saying is you don't regard this as significant difference insofar as what you want to happen to them is that there'd be a wall between you and them.
Yeah, that's right.
That they'd be isolated. What I'm saying is you can do that without a criminal conviction. The criminal conviction has the added power of saying, in effect, you were evil. We hereby condemn your actions as morally offensive to us. That's the difference. But I think what a lot of writers are suggesting, just what you're saying, and that is to say, let's get the sort of moral condemnation out of it. I think that has a whole lot of other things. And just say, you go here. That's the guilty but mentally ill, right?
Yeah.
You go here. The actual truth about guilty but mentally ill is that it was strictly a political deal. Strictly a political deal to cut down the number of insanity defenses that were successful. And I can tell you how that played out in the states that did it. I know the people who wrote the first statute, all they wanted to do was to cut down the numbers, you know, of insanity defenses.
You've been talking about mentally ill, and would you speak about mental retardation? And, you know, there are some cases that are really pretty sad to me.
They are, and those are the easiest cases. I mean, they're easy to verify, they're easy to document. Juries are very sympathetic with those kind of cases. Notice all of these defenses that I gave you on the green sheet, always say mental disease or defect, mental disease or defect. And most of the time, the way that that's understood is a defect is a condition not capable of improving or deteriorating. A disease is something that's in flux. But those cases with all kind of physical markers and organic brain differences,
and so
they're easy.
But wasn't there
they never case, even get to trial.
But there was a case recently where IQ of 65 that was got the death penalty.
That's been Georgia.
Yeah.
Well, but IQ by itself in those kind of cases doesn't tell you a whole lot. It tells you some.
What about the problem?
Wait, this gentleman back here.
I just read a study that was kind of interesting. It was a fellow who was studying the ability of people who were delusional to resist voices that were telling them to do things that they knew were wrong. Mm-hmm. And the thing I thought was intriguing is that there are differing abilities of people who have delusions and mental illness to withstand evil impulses. I think it's probably important to realize that just like we have, all of us have evil impulses, mentally ill people have them, and they probably have different abilities to resist or to withstand. And I think the essence of the four cases you presented there, I think, is the will, that in the first three cases, there's nothing in the person's will that can change what their condition is. In the fourth case, evil, you do have, or God has given us, a will to resist evil.
Right.
And like the lady said, we are responsible for that.
Right. One of the tactics that used to be used in the cases involving the will, the volitional side of the equation, the so-called irresistible impulse thing, is after the expert for the defense would say, we believe that he had an irresistible impulse at the time and couldn't help himself. Here's the question the prosecutor asks on cross-examination. You say he couldn't help killing?
Yes.
So are you saying that he would have killed with a policeman standing there watching? That's a wonderful question. Because either he says, oh no, he wouldn't have done it under those circumstances, which seems to say it wasn't irresistible. Or he says, oh yes, he would have done it even with a policeman there, in which case the jury ceases believing that expert witness. Because they know better than that. That's not a clinical question, that's an everyday question. What most clinicians would say to that is that that's a ridiculous question anyway. That's not the way life is. Life doesn't come down with a policeman standing at your elbow the whole time. A lot of the time you're left with your own control, not external control. But you're absolutely right. The other thing there that's kind of tough, and law students have a hard time with this one, is the jump from a mental impulse to the formation of an intention. It's a very different thing. I say, how many of you have intended to commit a crime? You know, they look at you kind of funny. Intended to kill anybody? No, that's clear. I've never had anyone who admitted to intending to kill. And then we mention some other things which might be criminal. And you can just see them. Like, did you know that if someone gives you too much change at a store and you recognize you got the wrong amount and you keep it, that's theft. Okay, that's very clear. Students go, oh. So how many of you, intend, and the hands start to go up. Well, what they're thinking about a lot of times is they have these impulses in their head. A good Freudian would say their id is talking to them, right? But they don't follow up on them. And what the law says is a thing isn't an intention unless you act on it. That's the way to tell when an impulse becomes an intention, if it'll support action. I don't think clinicians would quite agree with that, but at least legally that's a kind of an interesting way to test for intention. So the mere fact that you have, we all have bad impulses, and you can kind of, most of the time, fight them down, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir?
Is there any move afoot because of the notoriety that come from the more infamous cases of guilty by virtue of insanity, for the legal profession to say, just kind of eject the clinician and say, look, because of pressure on your profession, if for no other reason, but let's just eject the clinical part of this and say, no matter what the rationale for their crime was, they're still doing this to society, and so let's just treat them as you would any other criminal.
Yeah, there's some of that. I think what we could safely say is this, that the insanity defense in this country is greatly in disfavor and has been for probably 15 years. And you can see in each state a series of things that have made it harder to assert and harder to win on. Five states have abolished. No defense. Most states don't recognize it for volitional defects. For failures of the will, just failures of the intellect. Almost all states now put the burden of proof on the defendant to show he was insane. Classically, the state had the burden of showing that he was sane. Now, the burden of proof is there. A lot of states have added this business you talked about before, where there's another outcome. You got guilty, not guilty by reason of insanity, and guilty but mentally ill. That's a beauty. Guilty but mentally ill, we have that in Indiana. The jury probably thinks, he's guilty and he'll go away, but he's mentally ill. It turns out that the difference between guilty and guilty but mentally ill is no difference. Goes to the same place, gets the same evaluation, may get some help, may not, it's the same. I think it's kind of a fraud, myself. In fact, I wrote the legislature with a friend of mine, and we have a new bill called Guilty But Tall. It has just as much legal impact as guilty but mentally ill. Yeah, he's going away for 60 years, but he's a tall dude, isn't he? Big guy. Right? Yeah, kind of thing. Take one more. Yes?
From a practical standpoint, doesn't a prosecutor just look at insanity defense as just kind of raw meat? I mean, it's just...
Yeah, absolutely. Here.
I mean, they plead not guilty, and you know you've got a conviction. I mean, it's just about...
It's the absolute, with the possible exception of entrapment, it is the defense of last resort. It's the defense when you have nothing.
You've got to be crazy to use it as a defense.
The other thing, that's right. That's right. And whether you're crazy or not, you always say you're not, right? unless you're under indictment. Thank you all very much. Tomorrow morning at 10:30, we're doing something on the duress problem, and we're going to talk about a very famous hypothetical case involving some cannibalism. So if you're interested in that one.